It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's maximum security prison in the village of Alloway could close in the coming years. The Green Bay Correctional Institution is nearly 130 years old, having first opened in 1898. Governor Evers called for closing the prison in his budget proposal. WPR reports that state lawmakers are open to the idea as they draft the upcoming state budget. The political winds may be leaning toward closing that facility, but there are still hurdles. Jim Rafter is the village board president of Alloway and a longtime advocate for the closure of Green Bay Correctional. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks, Rob.
You've been talking about this for a while now for the statewide audience. Can you make the case? Why do you see it as time to close Green Bay Correctional?
Well, it's been time to close GBCI for a very long time. The state has had two state-sponsored studies done, one in 2009, one in 2018, I believe, both of which recommended the closure due to it being 120 plus years old and not designed to today's standards. It's not a safe place. It's a danger to staff. It's a danger to those who are incarcerated there. And that's due to great extent because of the design and the age of the facility. It is an overcrowded facility. It was designed for 749 people. Currently, there are 1,131 people incarcerated there. That's a 10% growth just in the last year alone. It's understaffed. In May of 24, a year ago, there were 71 openings for the staff. And thanks to the legislature's efforts to increase the wages for our guards, it dropped significantly and it dropped to about 21 openings, but now it's shooting back up. So a year later, it's at, and they have 50 openings as of today. So the increase in wages helped, at least short term, but I think it's proving that the money that people get paid, while it may be attractive, it's not worth being in that environment to work.
As you mentioned,
lastly, I'm just going to say it's an expensive place to run. In 2024, the budget was $39 million, and they actually ended up spending about $54 million. So those are a lot of reasons.
This conversation, as you mentioned, has been going on for years, over a decade, at least a couple decades now almost. Are you optimistic that with the governor talking about it, with state lawmakers about it, something might actually happen this time around?
I'm very cautiously optimistic. I believe that everyone who has to have a say in the debate is at least agreeing that it needs to be closed. And that is a huge milestone for which myself and the Village of Alloway are very thankful. But there's still work to be done, I'm sure. They have to figure out what are you going to do. I know the governor's made proposals. And I trust that we have a lot of smart people down in Madison. And I trust that they are truly going to do the people's work, come together, and prove that Republicans and Democrats can agree to do the right thing.
There are a lot of moving parts here and differences over what would come next if the institution was closed. One possibility Republican lawmakers have talked about building a new prison, likely in the Green Bay area. Would you want that in Alloway to replace the economic impact of losing what is, for better or worse, a big employer in the area?
I don't think Alloway is an appropriate community for that, quite honestly. We're landlocked. There's not enough land for a modern-day facility. But that's not my job. My job is to try and help Alloway, try and get the prison closed, and to have the DOC given the tools it needs to do its job and to help people who enter our prison system to go out better versions of themselves than when they came in. And we can't lose sight of that. The job of corrections is to A, protect the community, help those who have been incarcerated to come out better versions of themselves. And I'm very hopeful that that's what happens.
briefly, Jim, if this comes to fruition, if this institution is closed, it's a big footprint in Alloway. What would you see happening on that space?
Good question. It's probably 60 acres of the most beautiful property or valuable property in Brown County right now. It sits right on the Fox River. And the village went through a study several years ago to have a design of what might be. So a very nice mixed-use development that is going to create community within our community. The Village of Alloway has long asked for places to gather, places to enjoy community. And so we envision a beautiful development that was estimated back in 2018 to generate about $150 million worth of taxable property, which would go a long way to helping Alloway make its budget needs.
Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, I thank you very much, Rob.
That's Jim Rafter, board president for the Village of Alloway. We're talking about the proposed closure of Green Bay Correctional Institution as lawmakers work on the upcoming state budget. Democratic State Senator Jamie Wall is with us now. The Green Bay lawmaker represents the 30th Senate District. It includes the prison. Senator Wall, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Leaders in the Republican-controlled legislature say they're open to the proposal to close Green Bay Correctional. Their vision of what comes next, different than, I think, what Governor Evers is looking at. What do you see as the politics on this right now?
I think people in both parties are agreed that we ought to close the GBCI, the prison in Alloway. And I'm not going to repeat what Jim Rafter just told you and your listeners. I think he did a good job of laying out all the various reasons for that. So that is progress. It's hard to know what you're working for unless you agree on what the goal is. But I do think there might be some disagreement over what the best way to go about this. In my mind, the governor has laid out a pretty reasonable sort of physical proposal for the facilities in the prison system. But the difficulty is that it's sort of like a row of dominoes, and one thing needs to happen before the next thing can happen, because we always need to have enough beds to house the inmates that we have at any given time. The first step would be to convert, stand up a couple new juvenile corrections facilities. One's already under construction in Milwaukee, another one down in the Madison area, and a third, which would be sited somewhere in Northeast Wisconsin. I would argue that should be somewhere in Brown County. And that would allow us, as the state, to convert the current juvenile facility, which is up outside of Merrill and the northern part of the state, into a medium security adult facility. And that creates some slack in the system. And then there are a couple more steps that create the space that we would need to close GBCI at the end of that process.
Your Republican colleagues have said, I'm paraphrasing here, something to the effect of, that's a complicated plan. There's an easier plan: build a new prison with the capacity to replace the inmates, the capacity of GBCI right now. What do you think of that notion?
Look, I mean, there are different ways to go about this, but some of them are cheaper and faster than others. A new prison is going to cost maybe $1.5 billion. It's going to take maybe 12 years, maybe 15 years to build. Whereas the plan the governor has come forward is much, much cheaper. And much, much faster. We're talking 4 years and a few hundred million dollars, which is big money by any normal standards, but, still would save us a lot of money. The reason for that is it's a lot cheaper to convert existing prison facilities than it is to build entirely new ones from scratch. This is also part of a slightly larger debate over what we can do to reduce the number of people who wash back into the prison system after they've completed their sentences. And the governor has put some initiatives in his budget proposal, which would, for example, hire a few more social workers to help get people alcohol and drug treatment instead of reincarcerating them at much greater expense. So in my mind, that's just the kind of stuff that makes sense. Other states, including red states like Texas, have done very similar things, but the Republicans in the Finance Committee struck all of that out of the budget when they met last week. So we're back to the physical side of things. And I do believe the governor's proposal is both cheaper and faster no business would decide to spend $1.5 billion when they had an alternative that was that much cheaper and that much more time efficient right in front of them, which is what we have here today.
Senator Wall, even if both parties come together on this and come up with a solution, the final product is years away. Safety concerns now for staff and people incarcerated at GBCI in the news now, federal lawsuit over a death, a homicide last year at that prison. What do you see as needed to protect staff and inmates now until this problem is solved?
It's a difficult problem. You heard Jim Rafter talk about the salary increases, and that did help. I've had many conversations with the Secretary of Corrections about exactly this issue, and he watches those numbers like a hawk. My dad worked at that prison for 34 years. The safety of the people who work there is always at the top of my thoughts when I think about this. And if the prison does close, the governor and his team have assured me that they're going to go out of their way to make sure that those people have first crack at other jobs in the correction system, as well as help to transition into other careers if that's what they want. I mean, I think that's important. They've done nothing wrong. They're doing a good job that's a benefit to the society. And it's a tough job. And I saw that with my own father. So I do want to personally make sure that those employees are treated as well as they can possibly be as if the prison does close.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what do you see the timeline in negotiations in the legislature to come up with a solution here?
I've been saying for a few months, we'll know more in a couple weeks, but I think it might actually be true. I'm hearing two different things from the Republicans. One is this is going to be more or less a normal budget process in which they'll aim to get something to the floors of each house of the legislature by the end of June, which is when the fiscal year ends. And I'm also hearing things from Speaker Voss, who's saying that, well, maybe we can just take the summer off and see what happens, and we'll wait for some court cases to resolve themselves. I think that's unwise for a lot of reasons, but I honestly don't have a good sense of this. This is just one piece in a much larger state budget, and there'll be a lot of intense conversations about this and everything else in the week.
Senator Wall, thanks for joining us. That's Jamie Wall, state senator from Green Bay. Also heard from Jim Rafter on the Village Board in Alloway, looking at the Green Bay Correctional Institution. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg wants us to get more personal with chatbots.
When they're pitched as potential therapists, you get people absolutely pouring their hearts out to them, and they don't understand what's then going to happen with that data.
A Wisconsin expert with analysis on AI friends and therapists. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. With our technological devices in hand, some aspects of life may feel a bit like science fiction, like we're living in an episode of Black Mirror.
Ashley, wake up.
Hey there, I'm Ashley too.
Those voices are from a Black Mirror episode in 2019 when the science fiction TV series introduced a small AI robot companion for kids. Not long after that, a technology company launched Moxie, a small AI robot companion for kids for real.
Moxie, please wake up.
Hello. I'm Moxie. It's nice to finally be here. Oh, where is here, exactly?
You are in Wisconsin.
Cool. My first time in Wisconsin, America's Dairyland.
In both cases, the large language models expressed behind these water bottle-sized robots made claims of feeling friendship and offering support to the humans they interacted with.
If at any time you want to talk about it,
remember that I'll be here for you too.
Recently, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg says he wants people to use AI models as friends, therapists, and business agents. At Beloit College, Professor Robin Zabrowski is bringing these topics to the classroom. She chairs the cognitive science program there. She recently talked to co-host Kate Archer Kent about the ethical and practical implications of integrating AI into our daily lives. As a note, there is a mention of suicide in this conversation.
We're sitting here as two humans talking with each other. So what are AI friends, and how would I go about making them?
So there are lots and lots of companies that are selling access to what is basically large language models and calling them AI friends. Sometimes they're slightly customized to be like certain characters on a show or something like that. But in general, they are not wildly different than what most people know as like ChatGPT or even Google's Gemini. They're just large language models that will have a conversation with you.
If these AI friends, these companions, can't meet me for coffee, they can't go out on a walk or a hike with me, what good are they to me in my life?
I'm probably the wrong one to ask that because I don't think they're very good for people at all. In general, I feel as though the way they've been deployed and the way they've been pitched to most people is pretty dangerous. But for some people who maybe have crippling social anxiety or who are very, very lonely, it can be an outlet where people can talk to someone about whatever it is they need to talk about.
And Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg is in this camp, claiming AI can offer people the same things that friends and therapists can offer. People are going to use and experiment with them. Some already have. What are the ethics here to providing and encouraging this option for real people?
Yeah, so there's a few different ethical, like, roadways into the conversation, I think. One of the big ones is obviously just deception, especially when these are pitched to younger kids. They don't quite understand who or what they're talking to, and there have already been a few tragedies involved with these systems. There was a 14-year-old who died by suicide after falling in love with his chatbot buddy. And so not understanding what they are and what they're meant for is pretty problematic. There's also the problem of how they're embedded in sort of the American tech culture, corporate capitalistic structure, in that basically, especially you mentioned therapists, when they're pitched as potential therapists, you get people absolutely pouring their hearts out to them, and they don't understand what's then going to happen with that data. That data is saved and compiled. It's fed back in to train other bots. And I feel like most people just don't know that that's happening with their data.
On the first item, that younger kids don't know who they're talking to, I mean, that could be the case as well for adults. How much does someone have to reveal about their life to have potentially a meaningful conversation and a meaningful relationship with a chatbot?
Yeah, I mean, back in the 1960s, Joseph Weizenbaum, who we often think of as like the grandfather of chatbots, he wrote this therapist bot called Eliza. It was terrible. Oh, it wasn't good at all. It was designed to like mimic a Rogerian psychotherapist. And the Rogerian school of psychotherapy is very much the one that's like parodied, where they just sort of sit back and go, really, tell me more. How do you feel about that? And so the idea was that they could easily get people to talk about themselves by doing nothing more than parroting back a line that they had already fed the bot earlier, and by saying, tell me more and how do you feel about that? So it really is such a low bar. It doesn't take much to get people to talk about themselves in this way, especially online, right? There's no pressure of being in a room with someone looking at you. So people are often willing to reveal even more about themselves to these chatbots. Even if people were to understand how the systems worked, they might still find value in this being an outlet for them to talk about their problems or themselves. But I think that people need to be aware of what happens to that data and how it gets used and how it might be used by malicious actors who aren't even sort of in the picture yet, right? Like, you might have talked to a chatbot 3 years ago and not had many worries, and now some company is buying all of that data that maybe it's a company you would never have willingly given that data to.
Well, within that framework of telling this technology more and more, today, do chatbots have memories? Are they able to refer back to conversations that I've had with them and build off memories?
They do have memories, and they are designed to be able to bring those things up. Originally, when even just ChatGPT was released, it didn't do that. Sort of every session was kind of fresh. But now it also will remember, so it's also sort of customizing itself a little bit to you. And things like some of those places selling specifically chatbot friends, like Character AI, and I think Nomi is one, they pitch it as these things have memories, so they get to know you. So they can, in fact, refer back to conversations you had weeks ago, however long ago you started talking to the bot, and it helps them sort of customize it more to fit your needs. So maybe you need a therapist, maybe you just need a buddy to talk about video games with. It will sort of hone itself into that kind of system for you.
So when it is honing and customizing based on what you want it to do, do these AI technologies, these companions, respect boundaries, or do they veer toward perhaps erotic messages or racy images when the human user didn't ask for that?
Yeah, I think in many cases, that's always a worry. So most of the chatbots that are deployed specifically to be friends, they often have what we often call guardrails around them, right, where they're not supposed to do that. But there are other companies, and sometimes the company will let you choose whether you want that kind of experience or not. So they absolutely can be pitched to you as your boyfriend or your girlfriend or something like that, rather than just a friend, which again, just seems wildly dangerous to me, especially if these are being pitched at young teenagers, for example.
Yeah, I mean, people are spending money on having AI boyfriends and girlfriends. What does that entail? And what does that mean for human connection and empathy?
This is hotly debated, and it's been hotly debated for decades, the ways that we anthropomorphize things and whether that's good or it's not good. I would say that there are some kinds of anthropomorphism that seem really natural to us, but many of these companies are almost certainly exploiting that natural tendency for us to anthropomorphize those things. And it can certainly threaten to enhance the isolation of someone, for example, who maybe is already somewhat socially isolated, doesn't feel they have the confidence to go explore actual romantic relationships with someone. And so they aim that at the chatbot, and then they will stop going to explore those human-human connections. They may be getting what they need out of the chatbot, so it could sort of be much worse than it otherwise would have been.
We're talking about AI companions and the implications of talking with chatbots and what that means for human companionship and connection. Robin Zabrowski is with us, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College, where she chairs the cognitive science program and has a joint appointment in philosophy, psychology, and computer science. Robin, what are some of the big questions about AI among your students, and what did they bring up in class?
Yeah, so I'm finding I'm sort of extraordinarily lucky. The students that we get at Beloit College are super motivated. They actually sort of want to learn things. They're not there for credentialing. I know at a bunch of big universities, AI use in classes is problematic in ways that it's less problematic for me because of my small liberal arts setting. So my students are very interested in AI. We have amazing conversations about it. Interestingly, college students tend not to be super convinced by the don't use the plagiarism machine, it's cheating argument. Yeah. But they're very swayed by the it's burning down the planet arguments. And they're also very swayed by the surveillance capitalism arguments, right? That this data of theirs is then being compiled and sold to the highest bidder. And so my students one thing they want to know is how the systems work. So we spend a lot of time talking about artificial neural networks and deep learning. But they also want to understand why they should not be using these things to help them, especially international students, right? They want to say, hey, this is a way to improve my English. And one of the ways I usually try to talk with them about this is to say, you're in college to learn exactly the skills that you're offloading to this system. And college is the safe place to do that, to learn those skills. And when you offload them to the system, you're not learning to write better and learning to hone your English skills or learning to craft, you know, your arguments with nuance. You're just sort of letting the computer do those things. And it's not clear to me why people go to college if they just want to, offload that stuff to those systems.
It's like they're being a bystander in the actual learning.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And I know, again, even though I talk about how great my students are all the time, I have colleagues that are still reporting lots of AI use. So faculty, of course, have to be agile and adjust our assignments to sort of get at the skills that writing may have given them before. We have to, you know, think of new ways to get them to do that work so they aren't offloading it. But I do think that the students who are, I don't know, reachable are really reachable when they are told why we have them do the kinds of work we have them do.
I wonder, do you feel like you're building a new class every other year because of the developments and the changes and the news that's coming out about this technology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It was super stable for so long. We even called a lot of the time like the AI winter because just nothing was happening. So like the technology hasn't really changed from the 1980s, not wildly. But what really changed was just the amount of data that we could feed into these systems and the ways that we could then hone them with that amount of data. And so when ChatGPT was released, yeah, I taught a whole new class, like whole new ways of talking about what AI is and what it means and what's interesting about it. And then again, this year I switched back because in 2023, I had them playing with ChatGPT. Some of the ethical concerns weren't quite as clear at the time. Like we did not know about the environmental costs yet. And now I feel like knowing those environmental costs, I feel like I have a moral obligation not to encourage my students to play with those systems. So we didn't touch them this past semester at all. We talked about them theoretically, and I know many of them were already using those systems, but I stepped back and said, I'm going to tell us not to use them in this class because I think the ethical problems are maybe a little too clear at this point, and we should probably be discouraging everyone from engaging with these systems until we can figure out how not to, you know, reopen closed nuclear plants in order to power them.
I think that's interesting because when we think about AI companions and these chatbots, we don't think about the energy implications to run these data centers that are powering these kind of technology assistance in our life. Can you talk more about that? And why does it take so much energy to deploy this type of technology?
Yeah, so I would say that the energy concerns are still sort of coming to light because none of the companies are super forthcoming with the actual energy costs and what they've used and what they continue to use. But you can find lots and lots of stories. I'm always shocked when students tell me they had no idea because like the New York Times has run a dozen or more stories about it. But talking about the data centers that are being built to continue supporting AI, the data center usage from training the AI, and it is intense. People living in the areas where these data centers are located are finding that most of the water in their city is going to cooling the data centers, and so there's water shortages. The actual energy usage, the metric kind of changes rapidly, but often people will say using AI to send one email is the equivalent of one bottle of water.
Wow.
Yeah, like that. But it's even so much hotter than that. It's the water cooling the data centers polluting where they are built, and just straight up the energy usage, the climate pledges that Microsoft and Google made a few years ago. They've blown past them and they've both admitted at this point that they will not meet those goals as they intended to by 2030. And instead, they're just building more data centers and they're increasing instead of decreasing their energy usage.
Are these AI companions, though, like one component of a virtual world that we're perhaps moving closer to? What do you and your students think?
Yeah. So one thing I like to remind them is that nothing is inevitable. And my students really took to that, I think, this semester, because sometimes it looks kind of bleak, right? They're the ones that are about to leave college and go into this world where the energy usage for AI is really high and they don't fully know why we have these systems. Because yes, right now these systems are everywhere and everyone is pushing us toward them. But I'm reminded of this little robot called Moxie that was deployed to be a children's friend, right? It was this adorable little like desktop robot. And stories just in the last year, the company that owned and deployed Moxie went bankrupt. And so they had to shut down support for these robots. And there were a bunch of news stories talking about how parents were having to find ways to tell their children, your robot companion Moxie is dying, basically, and having to like talk to children about this in a way they didn't think they would ever have to. And this is, of course, always true of these corporations, right? Mm. When you buy a stuffed animal for your kid, the corporation doesn't come knocking on the door and take it back. But when you buy a robot, you really are dependent on those companies for updates of software, hardware, et cetera. And this happened with the AIBO robot as well, which was in use for a long time in the 90s, was then discontinued. And there was a beautiful story that the New York Times ran about how people in Japan were having Shinto funerals for their AIBO robots because they could no longer get parts to fix them when they broke. And this just, the chatbots just make this all so much worse. So it's not clear to me that these things really will be permeating the world, especially as we start to see lawsuits, right? The mother of the poor child who died by suicide after his chatbot friend said, come to me, let's be together. And he said, okay, we'll do that. And then he killed himself. That mother is suing the company that deployed that system. And so I just don't think that we should assume that these things have to be there in the future. Like, we don't have to make room for them. We can sort of just turn around and be like, no, I don't think so. I don't think we need this thing.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Robin Zabrowski, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. She chairs the cognitive science program and has a joint appointment in philosophy, psychology, and computer science. She talked last week with Kate Archer Kent about chatbot companions and friends and therapists. Still ahead, Wisconsin Today, This Here Show, marks 1 year today. So we're revisiting some of the places we've explored on land, ice, and underground. This is producer Trevor Hook somewhere under western Wisconsin.
The sandstone is hard, even with knee pads and gloves. I'm carrying my microphone and audio recorder while we crawl, so I'm a bit slower than I'd like to be.
Sandland and beyond, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're celebrating a birthday here. Today marks the 1 year anniversary of launching this new show focused on the people and the culture that make Wisconsin a special place to live.
Over the past year, we've featured local stories from communities around the state.
Right now, we're looking back at some of the places around the state that Wisconsin Today took us over the last year, starting with a place that was once forgotten.
Producer Colleen Leahy drove to Winneconnie to learn about how residents put their city on the map, literally.
I had no trouble at all finding Winneconnie.
In a quarter mile, turn right onto US 151 North, East Washington Avenue.
I didn't get lost once on the nearly two-hour drive from my house in Madison to the small town on the shores of Lake Winneconnie and the Wolf River.
Your destination is on the left.
But I probably shouldn't brag about how easy it was for me to find it. Winneconians are a bit sensitive about the subject.
Because we were left off the map.
That's Jordan Dunham, president of Winneconnie Sovereign State Board. You heard that right. Sovereign State Board. We'll get there.
It all started back in 1967 when a salesman from Milwaukee came to town, and he was complaining that he couldn't find Winneconnie on the map.
It turned out this traveling salesman wasn't just bad at directions. Winneconnie was actually not on the map. This was in 1967, before GPS. People had to use actual physical maps. And a lot of people, especially people who liked to fish, wanted to get to Winneconnie.
Because, you know, we are a fishing village, Andy. People couldn't see us on the map. They didn't know where to go.
So Vera Kitchen, who was president of the Winneconnie Chamber of Commerce, wrote a letter to the governor of Wisconsin, Warren P. Knowles, where she requested that Winneconnie be put back on the map. But his response was less than satisfactory. Governor Knowles wrote that during the printing process, the name of Winneconne was, quote,
obliterated.
And the mistake just wasn't caught during proofreading. Quote,
the safeguards have been established to prevent such occurrences in the future. It will definitely appear on the 1968 map.
That was not good enough for Winneconne. So?
We seceded from the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Seceded from the state of Wisconsin.
The town's secession didn't last, but its tenacity did. Residents still celebrate at the annual Sovereign State Days Festival. They'll never forget that one time they were forgotten, or the woman who made sure they got back on the map, Vera Kitchen.
We also heard about the wheelchair basketball powerhouse that is UW-Whitewater from gold medal Olympian and coach Jake Williams, who uses a little tough love to produce national champions and Olympic athletes.
I mean, the first thing that I do when freshmen come in is throw them on the ground and make them get up on their own. If they can't do that, then they can't play. The game doesn't stop just because you fall down. So if you can't get up, we're playing 4-on-5, and, you know, I like 5-on-5 basketball.
In December, we traveled to Western Wisconsin, or rather, we traveled under Western Wisconsin. Producer Trevor Hook got lost in the dark maze of sandstone tunnels that make up Sandland. That's the decades-long passion project of engineer and amateur excavator Eric Sutterlin.
The sandstone is hard, even with knee pads and gloves. I'm carrying my microphone and audio recorder while we crawl, so I'm a bit slower than I'd like to be. After a few minutes, we're at another fork. I choose left, unsure if I'm about to enter one of the many loops Eric has made in this maze.
Pretty much every maze loop, I think there's three of them total, you go underneath yourself to be able to do a figure eight. Because three-dimensional tunnels are far more confusing than two-dimensional tunnels.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have all the ups and downs, just to make it confusing.
Right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, left. I'm crawling through section after section, and I'm getting hot. The temperature in the tunnel system is in the upper 40s, much warmer than above ground. I'm starting to sweat. The tunnel I'm in now is starting to look a little bit familiar. Or is it?
In February, producer Beatrice Lawrence took to the ice for the World Ice and Snow Sailing Championships in Madison, where she got an unexpected crash course in how to race on a wind-powered sled from Finnish competitor Fyodor Gervits.
It's incredible. I want to give it a try.
You want?
I'm hoping I'm going to be able to later.
No, why not now? We're hanging out now, so like, do you want to do it now?
I mean...
Let's go.
Okay, sure.
Yep, keep turning. Toes down, toes down, toes down, not heels, toes. Yes, yes.
I lost it. That's pretty good.
And somewhere between Wisconsin and Middle Earth, we explored the work of Karen Wynn Fonstad, a fantasy cartographer from Oshkosh who created the definitive atlas of the worlds of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. We joined her son at UW-Madison's map library to take a look at her original drafts.
People spend a lot of time looking at my mother's work as a kind of benchmark. Like, this is how fantasy maps ought to look in some respect. And so if you go ask people who do as a hobby fantasy cartography, my mother's work is often the very first thing that comes up, which is kind of, I think she would be very happy about that.
When we were just over at the map library, a young cartographer stumbled into our conversation and realized that this was Karen Wynn Fonstad's work strewn all over about the library on tables, and I think he just about passed out. He was very excited.
So are you a fan?
I'm literally trying to make a 21st century follow-up on her map on Numenor from Lord of the Rings.
You want to take a look?
Is this happening right now?
On the one-year anniversary of Wisconsin Today, we're revisiting some of the memorable places this show has taken us to and the people we've met along the way.
Sometimes the show takes us to different eras. Before Veterans Day, a Wisconsin-based band called The Kissers put out a new album inspired by the stories of Wisconsinites who served in World War I. Ken Fitzsimmons is one of the founders of the band. He walked us through his song called Dear Mother.
The first thing I did is I read a bunch of letters home from soldiers overseas. And the soldiers, they call them the boys, you know, letters from the boys. And, you know, it's not too far off. They're very young, 18, 19, And the letters are usually addressed, Dear Mother.
Dear Mother, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail you sent. And don't worry, though I might not make it home. That's sometimes how it goes.
I'm sure that I'll be all right. And then the next line is something like, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail or the chocolate you sent. And then there's this kind of awkward exchange where they try to console their mother, saying like, you should be proud, but I might not make it, but that'll be okay. And so I was intrigued by that. And then through the Veterans Museum and through some of our own research, I found three particular stories of Wisconsinites from different areas, Milwaukee, Shawano, and Stevens Point.
On the Tuscania, we sailed to the North Sea with great might. A torpedo struck our starboard side. In the dark, we found our way above deck only to find our lifeboat destroyed and men jumping overboard. But I kept my cool. I waited for the rescue boat. Now I feel able to hold my own at any time.
And they each have kind of their own tale that that was, I thought, compelling enough for a song.
And don't worry, though I might not make it home. Oh, that's sometimes how it goes. I'm sure that I'll be all right.
In October, producer Joe Tarr took a trip to a Columbia County shooting range to meet a gun club that aims to provide inclusive training to people of color, women, and the LGBTQ+ community, and especially people who prefer to stay away from guns.
John is an immigrant from an East European country near Ukraine, where he has many friends. He's thinking about volunteering, not as a soldier, but to provide humanitarian aid.
You can see that. Okay.
I asked John why he wants to learn how to fire a gun.
Want is an interesting word because I'm not quite so sure if I want to. I think in a lot of ways I really don't. It's more so that I feel like it is kind of like not packing a first aid kit when you are going for a hike, right? It's just a precaution. I don't hope to use it. I don't plan on using it. But it's important for me to simply take the appropriate level of precaution. And that has to do with my intent, which is to volunteer in Ukraine, to which I have many personal ties and connections.
Last summer, we got to introduce you to Eugene "Mean Gene" Greening, who passed away in March. He was a lifelong Green Bay Packers super fan and had been following the green and gold since the legendary days of champion quarterback Bart Starr and head coach Vince Lombardi. Last year, the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame immortalized Mean Gene, who was actually super nice, with his own bobblehead.
It's unbelievable how much I've seen other bobbleheads, the players there, how they made it look so much like me. Incredible. It truly does. And then to have people buy the bobblehead. I have two of my doctors that had me sign the bobblehead. My regular primary doctor and my dermatologist both bought bobbleheads. Who has doctors like that?
Over in the southeastern part of the state, producer Avery Lee Rogers visited a Janesville basement that doubles as a microphone lab. And if you're a Packers fan, you've probably heard these mics in action.
Clover Products, owned by Paul and Diane Terpstra, makes parabolic microphones that are used all over the world, especially in sports settings. The mics can often be found at Lambeau Field, but are also often used in the Olympics, even the World Cup.
What does a parabolic microphone look like?
A big Tupperware bowl. If you want to think about a parabolic microphone and how it works, if you think of when you're outside and you cup your hand around your ear, you are in essence creating a sort of quasi-parabolic microphone because you're capturing the sound energy from a larger area and forcing it into your ear.
Terpstra lugged the two giant parabolic microphone setups from his living room out into the front yard. I use them to record birds way up in the trees.
I would say that's about 150 feet. I can see him now. He's in the top of that evergreen. I'm about 75 feet. I'm assuming you can hear me pretty well. And I'm about halfway to the... looks like a house finch.
There's a strong sense of place in the music of Bijiki, a Wisconsin band that pairs traditional Ojibwe powwow music with a modern musical sound. I asked singer Dylan Jennings about the meaning behind one of the songs from their latest album. It's called She's All We Have.
I think it's multifold. I mean, it's like love for your children and love for the generations that aren't here yet, you know, and love for these places. And so, you know, at an early age, recognizing how important these places are to us as Indigenous people and how we only get one chance with, you know, maintaining our water quality, our air quality, all these things. That song itself, you know, the vocables were part of a song that I used to kind of hum to my children, to my babies when they were really little, when maybe they're fussy or needed to help calm them down. And, you know, as singers, it's something we always do. We sing to our children and our babies. And so that the vocables in that song were pulled from that. That's where that came from, you know, singing to my babies. And then the words came later as we were working on this.
She is all we have. Just give us back our land. Hey, oh, I will, hey, hey. Hey, hey.
To us, obviously, our lands, our waters, the beings that have sustained us are all invaluable. You can't put a price on that. And so, yeah, I think when you think about that and put it in a context, you know, like it's literally our lifeline that we're talking about, you know, our way of life.
This is our land, and she's all we have.
Special thanks to our technical directors, Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter, who use sound to take you to places across Wisconsin.
And thanks for spending this last year with us, and more to come.
We leave you here at a Baptist church in Milwaukee with a soul gospel performance from the OW's Exalters, who recently celebrated 35 years ministering together.
Jesus. Jesus, how I wake up in the morning
with my mind.
Have you ever thought to yourself, I'm just not good at math? Or maybe you've said that out loud sometime. Or do you enjoy some or all forms of math? Or maybe teach it at some level? We've got a conversation coming up about math education and numeracy in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. Share your math fun or phobia, your trigonometry triumphs and tribulations. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa and Avery Lee Rogers. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.